From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, two generations of women comics. We ask the thin and glamorous Joan Rivers why she still makes jokes about being fat and ugly. And we talk with the duo Kathy and Mo about their inside parodies of the women's movement. Their off-Broadway hit, The Kathy and Mo Show, comes to HBO this weekend. Carol Burnett has a new TV show. David Bianculli has a review. And in the wake of yesterday's disclosure by Magic Johnson that he tests positive for the AIDS virus, we examine some of the controversies surrounding the testing of professional athletes for AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization ended their two-day summit meeting in Rome today with an agreement that radically changes the mission of the military alliance. NATO leaders acknowledged that surprise attack from the Soviet Union is no longer a threat and invited the Soviets and their former allies to take part in a North Atlantic Cooperation Council. At the same time, though, NATO issued a statement urging the Soviets to keep their nuclear weapons under the control of a single authority. The document also urged the Soviet Union and its republics to adopt a free market economic system. French President François Mitterrand objected to that provision, saying that the alliance had no business preaching economics to the Soviets. He refused to sign the statement. The governments of several Yugoslavian republics have criticized the European Community's decision to impose economic sanctions on the country. Pierre Vickery reports the Serbians are reacting angrily.
The sharpest criticism of the European Community decision to impose trade and fiscal sanctions against Yugoslavia has come from the Serbian government in Belgrade. The chairman of the Republic's ruling Socialist Party said the sanctions were a threat to impose poverty and hunger on those in Yugoslavia who were fighting for the country's existence. The Bosnian president, Alija Izetbegović, said his republic would suffer because of a quarrel which had nothing to do with the people of Bosnia. And the Croatian prime minister, while welcoming the community's criticism of the Serbian-led Yugoslav army, said the sanctions failed to differentiate between the aggressor and the defender, between Serbia and Croatia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The Bush administration wants to sell Saudi Arabia more Patriot missile batteries. Pentagon sources say Congress has been informally notified of the decision. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Earlier this year, Congress approved the sale of 8 Patriot systems, which are scheduled for delivery over the next 2 years. Now lawmakers are being asked to okay the sale of 14 additional batteries, which include 700 of the defensive surface-to-air missiles. The sale is worth some $3.3 billion. Yesterday, the Pentagon said it would not sell Saudi Arabia 72 F-15 jets, at least not for the next several months. The administration says such a sale would send the wrong message at a time countries in the region are taking part in peace negotiations. However, the Patriots are defensive in nature, and administration officials say Saudi Arabia needs them because of the continued threat posed by Iraqi Scud missiles. The White House cited that threat in September when it said it was lending Riyadh 2 Patriot batteries. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street after a session of mixed trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points to finish the day at 3,045.62. This is NPR News. Firefighters in Chicago say that a family of 10 was found dead in a Southwest Side house today, the apparent victims of carbon monoxide poisoning. Neighbors say that the family consisted of a couple and their 8 children, ranging in age from 11 to 25. A fire department spokesman said the bodies were found by firefighters responding to reports of an unconscious person. The spokesman cautioned that the cause of death is still under investigation. With the onset of cold weather, authorities have warned that carbon monoxide can build up as a result of faulty heating equipment or blocked chimneys. The 12th church fire in as many weeks struck north central Florida today. The largest church in Jacksonville Beach suffered extensive damage. More from Cindy Hosbein of member station WUFT in Gainesville.
Investigators from the State Arson Task Force are sifting through the rubble of the First Baptist Church in Jacksonville Beach. It's the city's largest church. The administrative offices were destroyed by the blaze, and the sanctuary suffered heavy smoke damage. Arson is suspected, and police spokesman Ralph Anderson says every church in Florida should be on guard from now on.
The churches ought to be aware and ought to take steps to make their buildings more secure, be aware of who's coming around. But quite frankly, something like this in the middle of the night, you know, I don't know what you can do to prevent it other than guarding every church.
Anderson says two men have been taken into custody for prowling but have not been charged in connection with the fire. Since summer of 1990, 28 churches in north central Florida have caught on fire with damages running in the millions. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Hosbein in Gainesville, Florida.
A Texas judge today granted a new trial for the woman convicted of trying to hire a contract killer to improve her daughter's chances of making the high school cheerleading squad. Wanda Webb Holloway was convicted of trying to hire a hitman to kill Verna Heath, whose daughter was competing with Mrs. Holloway's daughter to be a cheerleader. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When she guest-hosted The Tonight Show, she never invited me on. When she had her own show on Fox, you didn't see me on there either. Now she's got an Emmy Award-winning talk show. Still, no invitation. But I've invited Joan Rivers to be a guest on Fresh Air, because that's the kind of person I am. Joan Rivers has a new memoir called Still Talking, and it's given me the chance to talk with her. The book covers everything from how she writes jokes to how she survived the most difficult period of her life. After her husband Edgar's suicide, Rivers was devastated. It was 5 months before she went back on stage. She told me what that first night was like. After all, so many of her jokes had been about Edgar.
It was very difficult. They didn't know. I was hanging over the audience. It was hanging up. Her husband killed himself. She was fired from the Fox network. She's finished. She's over. She's not funny. I really think they came to look. And tremendous tension. And I was very nervous. And I figured, you might as well go. It was the way I've handled my whole life. Go out and just talk about it from the beginning. And instead of waiting till the end to talk about it, I walked out and talked about it at the start and made them laugh. And that cleared the air. And I thought to myself, oh, thank you, God. I can continue as a comedian.
So what kinds of things did you say about Edgar or the suicide in your act?
Well, you have to deal with it. I mean, these people were not stupid. I said, my husband killed himself, as you all know, and he asked to be cremated and have his ashes sprinkled in Neiman Marcus, because then he knew I would visit him every day. And they laughed. And that was the only reference I made to it. And it was just fine. It was just enough.
Now, you say that your audience didn't want you to be sexual when you went back to comedy.
No.
What kinds of jokes weren't going over?
I'm not a sexual person, certainly on stage. And they loved hearing about my sex life when I was married. They didn't want to see a 52-year-old woman at that point talking about dating. And they just didn't want to hear. And there was one joke, which is so indicative. I had written this joke saying, I don't think I'm good in bed. I said to a man last night, why don't you call out my name while we're making love? And he said, I don't want to wake you up. And that got such a gasp from the audience. So I changed the joke to say, I don't think I was good in bed when I was married. I once said to my husband, why don't you call out my name while we're making love? And he said, I don't want to wake you up. And it got a big response. And I realized right then and there they didn't want to hear dating jokes or any kind of any innuendo about sex for me currently. Not that there was any, but, you know, you write these jokes. But you write these jokes. You know, you come up, well, I'll do a whole thing on going out with a man. He tries to make out with me. You know, something like that. Or I try to make out with him. And I realized they didn't want to hear that from me.
Now, so much of your material over the years has been about how you look, you know, about feeling unattractive, about being too heavy, about not being sexy. Yet for years, your onstage look has been positively glamorous. You have gorgeous clothes. You're incredibly thin. You've gone through plastic surgery. You look terrific. So does it ever feel like the material is out of sync with who you really are, who you've really become?
No. Everybody tries. Look, I don't know, one person listening out there gets up in the morning and says, I think I'm going to pick the ugliest outfit and I'm going to try to look really unattractive today. We all try to look the best we can, and I've just done the best I can with this package, you know? But I diet all the time, and I try to look good, and the wrinkles are coming on, and No, I don't look hot at all. I look good for what I started out as, but that's it. So it doesn't. Then they look at me on stage and they go, "Yeah, she's right. She is a pig." There's no question about that.
So your self-image is still in keeping with the kinds of jokes you tell about
yourself.
Oh,
yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you still tell jokes about being heavy?
I get on a scale twice a day, and I am still heavy. I've seen myself in a bathing suit. This is not thin, you know, skinny mini over here. My thighs, a family of 18 could live on them for a year if you put ketchup on them.
I see. I think that's a very funny joke, but I look at you and I think, you know, you're seeing somebody different in the mirror than who you really are.
I hope so. I hope so. Because what I see in the mirror, boy, I don't like.
Well, why did being overweight and feeling, that you weren't attractive have such a profound effect on you?
Well, I think it has a profound effect on everybody. When they write in your yearbook, "Here comes fat, fat, the water rat," you don't forget that. That ruins your yearbook. You don't forget it when you come down the stairs at college and a blind date says out loud to the guy standing next to him, "Why didn't you tell me?" These are things that scar you very, very deeply and stay that way. You know, that's it.
How did you feel about the recent TV Guide cover story on celebrity plastic surgery? And the cover had a before and after picture of you on it.
I don't get plastic surgery. Celebrities will tell you they were raped by their mothers, they were beaten, incest. I mean, they will tell you the most. One comedian, you know, was saying how her parents took excrement and put it all over her, you know? And you say to them, "Did you have a face of, what, me? Never." I don't know. And everybody has done it. And I just think people should, see, tell the truth. What is so terrible to say, "I want to look better, and I had my nose thinned. I want to look better, and yes." I mean, Jane Fonda, who was into exercise, as we all know, has had the facelift, has had the boobs done, has had God knows what. And that's fine. Why are we playing this game? I don't get it. So I was delighted to come out and say to my audience, "I'm going in now because my eyes look like hell, and I'm getting a really bad under-the-chin look." Delighted to do it.
I'll tell you the problem I have with plastic surgery, and tell me what you think of it. I think that we're just creating this just impossible ideal. And I think of, like, the young Joan Rivers who was uncomfortable with how she looked. Imagine if she felt she had to live up to
the kind of
body and face that could only be created by surgeons.
Let me just tell you something, and it's very nice to say, and I'm already bored to death. Let me just tell you something. We're in a business where you have to look good.
Yeah.
Where they fire people because they're getting old. And it's very easy to say, "Let's grow old." The public doesn't want to see an old puss giving the news, and you know it, and talk to Jane Pauley at 40.
So you feel that you really have no choice.
There is no choice in our business. There is no choice. We didn't want to see Elizabeth Taylor jowly and horrible. We're thrilled to see her looking good again. We're thrilled to see Sophia Loren looking beautiful. I mean, who are we kidding?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Rivers. She's got a new memoir called Still Talking. I was interested to read about the working method that you developed early on for writing your jokes. You said that you can't just sit down and write jokes.
Yeah.
You needed to, like, work off somebody. So you used to have Rodney Dangerfield come over.
Yes, we were all very young in those days.
So tell me how you would work together, what the process was like.
Process is just, I come out of Second City, which is all, you know, verbal. And we would sit and just start saying, "Okay, answering machine. Let's do jokes on answering machines." Okay, my answering machine. I'm so boring, my answering machine doesn't even pick up. No, that's not good enough. Okay, let's do an answering machine. All right, how about, I'm so boring, my answering machine put me on hold. Good. I mean, you just keep, the process is, you just bounce on one another, till you find something you like.
So Rodney Dangerfield was somebody good to bounce off of.
Wonderful. He was wonderful. Another man named Marshall Brickman, who wrote all the early Woody Allen movies with Woody, who's now writing himself and directing himself. Marshall was a joy, because you would come in and sit and laugh till you found something good.
Have you ever had people writing for you?
Oh, of course. And anyone out there that thinks they're funny, please send me some jokes. I pay $10 for every joke that I use.
Gee, that's not a lot.
It is when I buy the joke and paper it before I've even tested it. I think out of 100.
Oh, you mean like if I sent like you any lousy old thing, you'd.
Oh, no. They send me like a bunch of jokes. I'll say, oh, let me think, I'll try this one. I think I'll try 4. So I'll send them a check for $40. Then I take those 4 jokes and try them out. And if you're lucky, 1 joke out of 15 works, 1 joke out of 20 works, 1 joke out of 100 really works. It's very hard. Everyone sees different ideas of what is funny. And when I write jokes myself and they don't work, it's very hard for me because I think, but that's funny. Why aren't you laughing?
When you were subbing for Carson, did his writers write any of your opening monologues?
No, because his writers would, and they're right, and they were right, would give me the jokes they didn't want to give Johnny, which means Johnny got the good jokes. Johnny was paying them. If you write a brilliant joke, who are you going to give it to?
Right.
The guy that's paying you or the girl that comes in once a week who has nothing to do with your life or your future? So they didn't give me good jokes, so I would come in with my own.
Well, also, there's something so much, like from a woman's point of view about your jokes. I'm sure all of us writers, or certainly at least most of them, were men.
And again, the funniest jokes, of course, come from me. Mm-hmm. It truly ends up what I think is funny, my perception of something. Always is the strongest in my act.
When you started to perform, did you look up to the few women who were in the field, like Phyllis Diller, Toadie Field, Selma Diamond?
No. I never think in terms of comedy as male or female-oriented. I looked at Lenny Bruce because he told the truth. Mm-hmm. He told the truth. And as a very impressionable young woman, then right out of college, the first time I saw him, I went, but he's saying what I'm thinking. Maybe not with those words, because in those days you just didn't say the words that he said. But he's saying what I'm thinking, and that's what I want to say on stage.
What was your early material like before you'd really kind of developed the Joan Rivers persona?
Very shocking in those days. I played my first record, which really was my successful record for 1966, called Mr. Phyllis and Other Stories, which was about my hairdresser. And I played it for Melissa, and the record in those days was like, did you hear what this girl has on a record? I mean, you know, they didn't even know my name at that point. And my daughter and I said, isn't that sweet? In 1966, to say you were having an affair with a married man, and while he was engaged to me, his wife became pregnant, which is one of my jokes. So I don't think, my joke was, while he became engaged to me, his wife became pregnant, so I don't think he's sincere, was my joke. This shocked audiences. And my daughter and I said, isn't that cute? So what was shocking then is not shocking now. But I was always shocking within the framework of the time period.
When you started off, it was before you were married to Edgar. You'd been married once before. So did you have a guy in your life to do jokes about? You know, did you have like a name to use?
I had
a person.
I was having this affair with this college professor from Columbia who indeed was married at the time, separated but nonetheless married. And so I used that, and I used all the jokes which were true about dating. And my mother was crazy. She had 2 of us that weren't moving, as the expression goes. And I talked about that a lot. And my sister graduated from Columbia Law School at 21, was very pretty and nothing. And my mother would just, no matter what happened, you know, and I talked about in the act, if you saw an accident, my mother would say, that means a wedding. You know, she was always looking for, a man would be decapitated, the head would roll to my mother's feet. My mother would go, this means a wedding, this means a good. So that's what I talk. I always talk from truth. You know, I think that's very important for your act, that they know, even though there's a joke there, that you really mean what you're saying.
You're just joining us. My guest is Joan Rivers, and she's written a new memoir called Still Talking. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Joan Rivers is my guest. She has a new memoir called Still Talking. What was it like the first time you played Vegas?
Very frightening. I was so stupid. Again, it's all in the book. I thought Vegas was the desert, and I went out there for Thanksgiving, and I brought bathing suits and shorts. I mean, and it's cold. and they didn't know me, and I didn't know them, and I had brought a little black dress, and I spent the whole night with this wonderful woman named Ann Pierce, the dresser, pasting sequins on this dress to look like it came from, you know, the right place. Very hard at the beginning to play Vegas.
You say that it gave you a different perspective on the people who've lasted there for years. What did you start to respect about, like, the quintessential Vegas performers that you didn't respect before?
Well, you know, we all say, to this day, people call me when they don't like me, and there's a review. It'll always start out with Joan Rivers, comma, Vegas, comma, or Vegas performer, comma. And I went with the same snotty attitude, and my husband was so smart in so many ways. He said to me, these people have been around. Dean Martin's been around for 30 years. Before you get so snotty, go and see why. Go and look at Away Newton. And he would take me every night after my show to go and see the other performers. And I learned the magic of these old war horses, the energy that comes from these people, the incredible presence of these stars, these true Vegas performers. A wonderful. They're the backbone of our business. And boy, did I learn from that, that give all and the love that went back and forth with the audience. Tremendous learning process for me. I adored doing Vegas by the end of it. I was proud. You know, you turn the corner after my husband Edgar had died, and I couldn't work for so long. And then I went back, as we talked about, you know, to Las Vegas. And to turn the corner and see your name in lights 10 feet tall, and you think, I'm back, and it's wonderful.
How did you start doing celebrity jokes as part of your material? Yeah, especially like Liz Taylor, you know, dishing the celebrities.
How can you not? Elizabeth Taylor was on the cover of People magazine looking like a house. It was like and no one said anything. I went on the Carson show and said, did you see People magazine? Looks like Elizabeth Taylor ate her last two husbands. And the audience went insane. It was like someone saying the emperor's not wearing clothes. You know, it was that simple. And from then on, I said, just say what you say in private to your friends. Because that we all get on the phone with our friends and we all dish about people. You know that. We all know that.
Oh, not me.
Not me. Right. And that's how it started with all the jokes.
What's your attitude toward this on your own talk show? Because you have on a lot of celebrities now. Are you afraid of dishing them?
I just let my talk show, I'm so happy with, and I'm so pleased with how well it's doing. I just let the chips fall where they may. And people, I think, now know me so well. They say, oh, that's just Joan.
But, you know, a lot of times when you're talking to a celebrity or actress, whatever, I mean, they've come on to talk about being victimized or secret problems they've had to overcome. So is it going to make them is it going to make it harder for you to dish them the next time, you know, when they've come on the show to expose their sensitive side?
No, and everyone's got a sensitive side. And it's wonderful when you see that come out in an interview. I always love that when you get someone like a Carol Burnett, who was on very, very recently, and when she talked about being lonely. It was terrific to have Carol Burnett sitting there saying, I'd love to meet somebody. I'd love to have somebody in my life. That was a terrific moment.
If you're just joining us, Joan Rivers is my guest, and her new memoir is called Still Talking. You write in your book that there was a point when you realized that your husband Edgar no longer really belonged in your life, that you had really different needs, and you were really involved with your career. You liked being on stage, and things were just moving too fast for him, and then he got into real problems with the Fox show. He was kind of the lightning rod for...
He was the one that... He was, you know, because he was having mental problems, he was the one that anything that went wrong, they can blame it on him. You know what I'm saying. He was it, as they say. And it was a very difficult time. It was very difficult for me because I was defending my husband and protecting my husband and trying to keep the show going and dealing with people at Fox, many of whom I felt were totally totally incompetent. It was a rotten period of my life.
You say in your book that there was a period where you felt that you were somehow responsible for a suicide, but you know, much later you said to yourself, well, Edgar killed Edgar.
Yeah.
He killed himself. What was the turning point for you in starting to think of it that way?
Again, I work so hard for suicide prevention now and with suicide survivors because you feel the guilt. At one point, you just have to say to yourself, it was his choice. And at that point in his life, that was what he did, and I could not have saved him. But it's a long road coming to say that, coming to believe it yourself, and I still half times don't believe it. I still think maybe one more phone call. Maybe one more phone call would have done it. But he had to go into I couldn't help him. You reach a point. You've got to know when you say in your life with relationships, I can't help this anymore. We need an outsider to come in and help us. And that's what I had said to him. I said, you must go for help. I cannot do this anymore.
A little earlier, you talked about how when you started performing again after your husband's suicide, you felt kind of insecure that people would look at you and say, oh, she's been the victim of tragedy. And it would make it hard for them to see you as a comic. Do you think that your new book will bring back some of that or lessen that effect?
I don't know. I think what I would like the book to do, you know, it was wonderful. I thought God has only done this to me. Why? It was like, Job, why? Why is this happening? Why is this happening? Why? I mean, everything. The Carson, the end of Carson, I was treated so badly. And then the Fox thing, and then Iggy's heart attack, and Iggy's suicide, and my daughter and my relationship crumbled, and I couldn't get work. And it was like, what now, God? What now, God? And I had to put down two dogs the same week that my husband, killed himself. It was just horrendous. And then as I would talk, I went to a therapy group. And this woman walked in, I thought, oh, and looking so good, all Chanel and pearls and hairdo. And I thought, oh, yeah, honey, what have you been through? You know, I'm here because I'm miserable. What are you? And she began to talk, and her husband and two children had been killed in a plane crash. And I suddenly realized everybody's gone through something. And everybody has to come out of it, and we have to help each other. And I think that's what the book is about. It's showing for all of us you can you must get through, and you can get through.
So tell me, is there a man in your life now?
No, but that's okay. That's fine. You can't have everything. And I woke up the other morning, I thought, thank you, God. My daughter is well and beautiful and doing well on her own, which every parent worries about. And I've got a show, and we're doing just fine. And I've got very good friends. And it's okay to end up like this.
Well, it's not over.
No,
you're not
but
ending up. Or...
If this is where I'm going to be for the next 10 years, that's fine.
Well, I guess you feel pretty independent about it, too.
Yeah. Oh, of course. And I'm on my own. I stand on my own 2 feet. And I'm taking charge of my own life, and that's okay. That's great.
When you were young, I know it was like this for me. When I was young and I saw a woman who lost her husband, I thought, well, that's it. Life is over.
It's not over, but there are many, many changes, as every divorcee knows. As every woman...
Was that your feeling, though, when you were young? I mean, is that something you had to unlearn?
I never thought about it. When I was young, you never looked at anyone and said, oh, poor thing. You just never thought about it.
Yeah.
You thought, well, Aunt so-and-so lost her husband. You know, she'll come to a wedding and dance with another woman. And that was that. But it's very hard to suddenly be a single... It's a double-digit society. Everybody is a couple. And it's very hard to go out there alone.
Joan Rivers, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, a pleasure talking with you.
And Joan Rivers has written a new memoir. It's called Still Talking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, two feminist comics spoof the women's culture that they're part of. We meet the duo Kathy and Mo. Their off-Broadway hit, The Kathy and Mo Show, comes to HBO this weekend. Veteran comedian Carol Burnett is back on TV. David Bianculli reviews the new version of The Carol Burnett Show. And Washington Post sports writer Mike Freeman considers how Magic Johnson's disclosure might change the debate on AIDS testing in professional sports. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A two-day NATO meeting ended in Rome with alliance members offering friendship to Moscow, but at the same time saying that there should be strong control over Soviet nuclear weapons by a single authority. President Bush held a news conference earlier today in Rome. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports that Mr. Bush stressed a continued need for the NATO alliance to guarantee security and stability in a changed Europe.
President Bush described the Rome summit as a landmark event that has taken decisive steps to adapt the alliance to post-Cold War realities. He said that NATO is still a cohesive organization and does not need the Soviet enemy to hold it together. Bush pointed to the new relationship that has been institutionalized with NATO's former adversaries. The North Atlantic Cooperation Council will be a consultative and cooperation organization with Eastern European countries to help them in defense planning and conversion of defense industries to civilian uses. And addressing those he called isolationists at home, the president warned against the creation of a fortress America and stressed the importance of a continued American presence in Europe, which he said is in the U.S.'s interest. In Rome, this is Sylvia Poggioli.
In Poland, President Lech Wałęsa has called on a top political rival, Bronislaw Gajerzyk, to form a coalition to run the government. NPR's Tom Gelton in Warsaw has more on the story.
Gajerzyk was one of the first Polish intellectuals to rally behind Lech Wałęsa back in 1980 when Wałęsa led shipyard workers out on strike and formed the Solidarity Union Movement. But Gajerzyk and other intellectuals did not support Wałęsa's presidential candidacy last year. And after the election, they formed their own party, the Democratic Union. In parliamentary elections here last month, the union got 13% of the vote in a crowded field, enough to finish first. Wałęsa said the union's ranking entitles it to form a government, or at least try. It won't be easy. Gajerzyk will need the backing of at least five political parties to get his government approved by the parliament. The news that Wałęsa will support him came as a surprise. Gajerzyk has been one of Wałęsa's critics. Moreover, he is Jewish by birth, and anti-Semitism is still strong in Poland. In announcing his preference for Gajerzyk, Wałęsa appealed to Poles to put aside personal animosities. I'm Tom Gelton in Warsaw.
In Washington, there are reports that the U.S. plans to sell 14 more Patriot missile batteries to Saudi Arabia. The Associated Press, quoting Pentagon sources, says that the $3.3 billion sale, if approved by Congress, includes some 700 surface-to-air missiles. This sale would be in addition to eight Patriots already approved by Congress earlier this year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 8 points to close at 3,045.62 in very active trading. This is NPR News. Since the start of last year, the number of homeless people who are mentally ill has gone up 7%. That is a finding of 21 cities across the country. According to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, one reason for the increase in the number of mentally ill homeless is cutbacks in residential psychiatric care programs. Among the cities taking part in the survey were New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. Boston Mayor Raymond Flynn said that if both the White House and Congress made the homeless problem a number one concern, it could be solved. The bodies of at least 10 people, possibly the victims of carbon monoxide poisoning, were discovered late today in a house in Chicago's West Side. Cheryl Corley of member station WBEZ reports.
Officials from Chicago's fire and police departments responded to an emergency call late this afternoon. They found a couple and their 8 children dead in several rooms of a 2-story home. Neighbors said the family had been living there for about a year and no one had been seen since Wednesday. Mike Cosgrove with the Chicago Fire Department says the initial investigation shows the deaths were caused by a faulty furnace.
It appears that a flue to the furnace was backing up into the residence and was not ventilating to the outside.
The family included several teenagers. The youngest child was about 10. For National Public Radio, I'm Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
Senate Republican leader Robert Dole says that a loss by his party this week in the Senate race in Pennsylvania was a bitter disappointment. Dole said that he thought the GOP would win in Pennsylvania, but Democratic Senator Harris Wofford defeated former U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh. Dole says that he probably won't announce his political plans until after Congress adjourns, and he says the outlook for GOP senatorial candidates will be a factor in whether or not he runs again. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last Friday, CBS premiered The Carol Burnett Show, a new variety series that picks up where Burnett had left off back in 1978. The network didn't provide the critics review copies of the series pilot, a move that Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli says is usually the sure sign of a bomb. This time, however, David says that rule doesn't apply.
For Carol Burnett, this new series isn't so much a comeback as a come around. After all, she had a weekly sketch comedy showcase in last season's Carol and Company on NBC. But when NBC canceled that series, Carol decided to go back to CBS, and to the same studio and format that had been so successful for 11 years. In Carol and Company, she didn't want to duplicate the kind of show she'd done before. Now, with the new Carol Burnett Show, she's come around. The new show has lots of the old familiar elements. It starts with Carol taking questions from the audience, and the premiere show even made room for Carol's personal good luck charm, Jim Nabors, who was a guest on every opening season show from the old series. This time, though, he's in the audience, not on stage. An observer, not a participant. That's because, though this new Carol Burnett show takes care not to alienate its older, loyal viewers, it wants to appear to younger ones as well. Accordingly, the premiere guest this time was Martin Short, a sketch comedy genius in his own right, and a performer whose fans come from both SCTV and Saturday Night Live. Having Carol Burnett act opposite Martin Short is the variety show equivalent of Dustin Hoffman acting opposite Tom Cruise in Rain Man. It's a way for a veteran performer to get exposed to a whole new generation, as well as for younger actors to display their stuff to people equally unfamiliar with them. And for the most part, this works. As when Burnett played a TV newswoman who's interviewing a very defensive subject. Martin Short's famous, ultra-nervous Saturday Night Live character of Nathan Thurm.
You realize why there is such a controversy surrounding your new film, Jungle Beaver.
Well, Jerry Mather's conducting an affair with his black secretary is a jolting image, I suppose, but am I to be blamed for other people's prejudice? Talk about pressure.
Mr. Thurm, even you can concede that Jungle Beaver is nothing more than a shameless ripoff of Spike Lee's Jungle Fever.
Well, you say ripoff, I prefer the term sampling.
Then you do admit that you sample other films.
I didn't say that. You said that. Why, you think I said that? That's so funny that you think that, don't you think?
Carol has a new supporting cast for this series, but she was smart enough to keep Megan Fay and Richard Kind, the two funniest co-stars of Carol and Company. In this new series, Kind is the closest thing Carol has to a Harvey Korman. But the opener didn't even try to integrate the supporting cast with the headline guest star. Later shows, presumably, will be more democratic. However, the premiere did establish some nice touches. I thought it was neat to see the ragged edges at the end of sketches, hanging around for a while rather than cutting immediately to commercial. And there's some thought and imagination in some of the sketches, as when Carol Burnett and Martin Short play parents attending and reacting to a junior high band recital. The whole skit is a close-up of them in the audience. We never see the band, but boy, do we hear it. I have no idea why CBS kept the first show under wraps, because it worked. And if later shows are as good, the new Carol Burnett Show ought to be around a lot more than 13 weeks. Maybe even until 2001.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. This is Fresh Air. Kathy and Mo are feminist sketch comics who aren't afraid to satirize the women's movement. Their 1989 off-Broadway show was a big hit. It ran for 16 months. The show is taped for HBO, and it will run 6 times this month, beginning tomorrow night. Here's a short sketch from the show, performed by Mo.
It was hard winter. Lost half of crop in flood. I must farmland myself, husband is gone. Though I am left alone to feed 8 children and cow. So you see, I have no time to worry about feminine protection. Thank God for lilac spring tampons. With lilac spring, I can plow field, irrigate land. And still feel confident. Protected. And most important for poor dirt farmer, fresh.
Is there a story, Kathy and Mo, behind the sketch that we just heard?
Yes, there is.
Yes, there is. Can I tell my operator story?
Will you?
Yeah, I was a long-distance operator for AT&T for about 7 years. That's French for AT&T. And AT&T. And once I had my period and I wanted a tampon, so I leaned over to the woman at the console next to me and I said, you know, can I borrow, you know, can I have a tampon? And she said, I'm sorry, just a minute, let me look. She held her bag under her skirt so no one could see and looked. And she reached over to the person next door and said, you know, Wendy, Kathy needs a tampon. She said, just a minute. And I thought, I felt like I was asking for hashish. You know what I mean? It was like such a covert operation. I thought, just give me a... Anyway, so... So finally, somebody handed me a tampon, and I took a piece of tape, and I taped it to my forehead, and I walked across the room to the bathroom.
So we thought we'd write a skit about periods.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's still a lot of women comics who base their routines about on shopping and eating?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's better now is that before you could, no matter what you thought was funny, you could only talk about shopping, eating, and how ugly you were.
Right.
Or fat.
But now you kind of have the choice if you just happen to be the kind of woman who thinks shopping and eating and how ugly you are is funny, then you can talk about that. But I think that's a minority compared to all the other things that we have, resources that we think are funny as women, you know. How about shopping while eating?
Yeah. How about eating the clothes you buy?
There you go.
A lot of your sketches are about women or even the women's movement. Now, I want to play an excerpt of one of them. And this is a sketch about two older women who are very far removed from feminist culture and feminist lingo. And they take an adult education women's studies class to go on a field trip to a natural foods restaurant to see a performance of Sister Woman Sister. Here's the clip.
Oh, Madeline, take a look at this floral watercolor. It's so vibrant.
I love art. Let's see. Oh, beautiful. Yes, that's not... Oh, no. No, Civvy. That's not a floral watercolor.
No?
No, honey. That's a vagina on a plate. Okay? Okay.
That is so colorful.
Yeah. Pastels, you know.
Yeah.
Honey, I don't see anybody here, do you?
No.
Hello, hostess!
Yes,
waitress,
yes.
Anybody? Oh, hello,
darling.
Hostess. How are you, sweetheart? Yeah, we're here with the Women's Studies Field Trip Department. That's right. We're here to see Holly and Molly perform Sister Woman Sister. We want to be with that class, honey. Our teacher, Carol Perkins, made the reservation. So maybe she...
Sweetheart,
tell her that
I know, but maybe we should introduce ourselves. I don't mean to interrupt. I'm
oh,
sorry.
Oh, no. Thank you for coming.
Kathy and Mo, did this sketch come out of...
oh, wait a minute. Okay, sorry.
You've heard this a lot of times, haven't you?
Yeah, we have.
Did this sketch come out of imagining your parents going to a Judy Chicago art show?
Sort of. A little bit. Kind of. Well, my character, Sylvia, is loosely based on my grandmother and my mother and my Aunt Ruthie, who had a very deep voice. And so it's sort of how they would react.
What I found really funny about the sister-woman-sister thing is, I mean, one of the things that's bothered me about, like, quote, women's culture, you know, or parts of women's music is the sanctimony about being a woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The first time we did the show, a long, many years ago, when we were just children, I was really, that was the piece I was most nervous about. Mm-hmm. I thought, they're going to kill us, Kathy. They're not going to think this is funny like we do, meaning the sister woman sister poem. And she said, don't worry about it. But I think she was a little tiny bit worried, too. But then we got out there, and I think what happened was that the feminist movement sort of came of age a little bit, and we could laugh at ourselves.
Can I ask you to do the poem?
Mm, gosh. No. But thanks.
I don't remember it. Do you have a clip? Can you play the clip?
Oh, sister, woman, sister, mother, goddess, oh, goddess. That's all I remember.
Bring us into your fold.
Bring us into your fold, your mother-loving arms, your sister, woman, mother-loving arms.
Woman, W-O-M-Y-N. Woman. Solstice woman, which woman?
Oh, and you are born a girl.
No.
Not girl. Born woman, woman child.
Birth cycle. I am born from you and am of you I am.
We are birth, we are fetal, we are afterbirth. My placenta is yours and yours is mine.
So, sister, can I call you sister or woman of my life or just me? Are you me? Are we?
Come live in the great uterus of womanhood. Live in the walls the sack live. Cut the umbilical cord.
No, don't!
It is there.
Cord, cut, 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 cord, no, don't cut.
It's there.
I love that.
Oh,
yeah.
It goes on.
It's really great. No, Mo, I have to ask you, since you have, I believe you had founded a feminist theater company, or at least worked in one before.
Sure,
before
I
the Kathy and Mo show. Did you ever do performances like that seriously before finding the humor in them?
Actually, we both have been in feminist theater groups. And the one I was in was an improv group called Hot Flashes. Cute play on words.
Mine was probably even more sister woman.
Oh, definitely more. But we would sing this song at the end of our show called "Bring Out the Woman's Side."
Kind of goes like, "The woman's side, honor the woman's side. We all have a woman's side, women and men.
Bring out the woman's side, nurture the woman's side. Someday the world will be balanced again." We sang that totally seriously.
Oh, wow.
And we asked the audience to join us, which was the really embarrassing thing.
And I was in Sisters on Stage, SOS, and we did really radical. I mean, we did...
They tore it up.
Yeah, we did really street guerrilla feminist theater.
Yeah, ours was sort of a Betty Crocker feminist theater, as you can tell by that song. You know what I'm
ours
saying?
Ours was more like, get out the swords and...
Ours was, get out the pie pans and... Not the pie pans, none of us.
Terry.
So when did you start to...
I don't think that's any of your god darn business.
When did you start
to... Miss Nosy Parker, when did you start to, huh? I guess I was about almost 18 my first time. No. Start to what? Sorry.
Oh, when did you start to get tired of that,
bring on the woman's side?
Bring on the woman's side.
Immediately after she sang it.
Immediately before I sang it. Well, see, I was certainly a feminist, but I that sort of mushy feminist stuff.
She wasn't a Hallmark feminist.
No.
She was.
Although I did go to what were they called, a moon ritual with a bunch of feminists once, and it was really fun. But on my way there, I was totally making fun of it. And I thought, oh, moon ritual, what are we going to do? Run around on the leaves and pick flowers? Which we didn't, of course. We had a sense of humor about it, which is why I think we felt we could go ahead and have a sense of humor about it in the Kathy and Mo show.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you a lot.
Yeah, this has been fun.
The Kathy and Mo Show debuts tomorrow night on HBO and will play 5 more times through November. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, a report from Silvia Pajoli on the end of the NATO meeting in Europe. Also, the latest from Yugoslavia. We'll be hearing reaction to the announcement of Magic Johnson's retirement and the fact that he's HIV positive. We'll hear how some high school kids react to that news, and also what it might mean for the great basketball star's commercial endorsements. We'll also hear from the authors of the Harper's Magazine Index, and we'll be hearing a story about Doonesbury, the comic strip, and charges of drug use, allegations that were made against Vice President Dan Quayle. Those stories coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Yesterday, Magic Johnson told us he tested positive for the AIDS virus. The whole nation was moved by his disclosure and the grace with which he made it. Today, in the professional sports world, many people were wondering how this will change the debate on testing athletes for AIDS. Just last week, Washington Post sports writer Mike Freeman broke the story that the players on the NFL's Philadelphia Eagles were tested for AIDS as part of their routine physicals. All of the players tested negative, but some were alarmed because they weren't properly informed that they were being tested. Today, Mike Freeman continued to investigate AIDS testing and the impact of Magic Johnson's announcement on the sports world.
The main issue is, what will teams do next about testing? That's the main thing. Can the players and management in all the leagues work out something where there's some sort of voluntary testing, and what would happen? Everyone agrees that I've spoken with that there probably should be some sort of testing. But the problem comes and the snags come when what happens, the issues after the testing, what happens if someone tests positive? And also, are players now finally seeing that Magic has the HIV virus? Are they saying, wow, maybe we are human? And particularly in football, where week after week, every week, you go out and you just literally, your body gets beat up and you beat other people up and you come away and you walk away from, you're a gladiator. So it's kind of hard to see yourself as fallible. And then now, like a couple of the New York Giants players were saying, now it's, wow, I am human. And I'm getting my test done tomorrow.
Do you think a lot of players are going to want to be tested now?
What you're going to see at first is players are going to go on their own and get tested. I don't think they're going to go to management and say, test us.
Oh, because then management can say, well, now that we know you're out of here, whereas if
exactly. You
get tested with your own physician, you could keep it confidential.
Exactly. I think that's what you'll see. I think there will be a lot of players going to individual doctors or their own doctors or private physicians, but not, I don't think they'll be going to the team doctors to do this.
Do you think that the teams are going to try to get their players to go to the team doctors to do it so that management will know what the situation is?
They'll try. I think they'll definitely try. I don't think it'll work, though.
Why not?
Because the teams have no legal, from the best I can ascertain, they have no legal footing to make the players go to the team doctors to get tested for AIDS. I don't think they can do that. I think the players have every right to go to their own physician wherever they want to go and get the test done.
You know, to most of us, Magic Johnson's disclosure is, it's very tragic. We're all very upset that he tested positive for AIDS. I'm wondering what this means for owners of teams who look at sports from a financial perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what do you think is going through the minds now of team owners who are wondering, you know, just on a much more, you know, bottom line level about the implications of AIDS for their future?
Right, that's a good question. Most owners, not all, most owners see the athletes as products, as, like you said, bottom line. This athlete may bring in this amount of money. This athlete can do this for us, that type of thing. I think a possibility, and this was mentioned a lot also yesterday in terms of the NFL, right now they have scouting combines for college juniors and seniors. They test for drugs at these combines just to make sure that the owners that are going to pay the $10 million, the $20 million for these number one draft picks, make sure that that as one owner said, they're not damaged goods, quote unquote. I think what you're going to see at these combines, and I think the owners will be the ones who maybe push this, and personnel directors in the NFL, maybe even in the NBA, I think you're going to see possibly AIDS testing at these combines. There may be some, an agent I talked to yesterday, Brad Blank, who's a prominent sports agent, has a lot of NFL players, said what you may see are AIDS clauses in players' contracts, but they would never call it an AIDS clause. They may call it an illness clause. And it could be like an incentive, the same way now in a lot of NFL contracts you have clauses, they're nicknamed good citizen clauses, where players are given bonuses, $50,000, $100,000, to stay drug-free if they've had drug problems in the past. This agent sees similar clauses where you, if you stay free of sexually transmitted diseases, you get bonuses. It sounds completely outrageous, but it's very possible, and I think you're going to see a lot of different extensions from what happened with Magic Johnson down so many different avenues, and there are going to be so many different possibilities open up from this whole story. It's really one of the largest stories of our time.
What was your personal reaction yesterday when you heard Magic Johnson?
I guess, like most people, when I first heard about it, I really didn't believe it, and I've met Magic a couple times, and when I watching his press conference and knowing the way he is, I still couldn't believe how he handled himself. I still have been thinking about that all night. I stayed up pretty late till about 3 a.m. last night, and I got up and watched all the morning shows and listened to all the radio shows this morning, and I still, looking back at how he handled himself during that press conference, for people that have never met him, that shows you the kind of person he is. He's willing to sacrifice his privacy and something very personal to him to help others become more aware of the disease, and particularly in the Black community. But I still am kind of numb about it. It still hasn't really hit, you know? And I guess sometime down the road it will, but like most people, I'm still kind of numb about it.
Mike Freeman is a sports writer for The Washington Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester, and it's performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet rocker Dave Alvin. He played a big role in the Los Angeles rock scene as a member of the roots rock band The Blasters, as part of the post-punk band X, and as the frontman for the All-Nighters. Now he has a new solo album. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.